Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guests are Ellen Averill and Andy Weisslogel. Averill and Weisslogel are both curators with the Herbert F. Johnson Museum of Art at Cornell University. Ellen Averill is chief curator and curator of Asian art. She's also an adjunct instructor in the art history department at Cornell University. And Andy Weisslogel is the associate curator and master teacher at the Johnson Museum. His primary area of expertise is in Renaissance and Baroque works on paper. Welcome to the show to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, you both received degrees in art history, and I'm always curious about what makes someone passionate about certain things. Do you want to begin, Ellen? Tell us how you got interested in art history in the beginning.
Well, it starts out with when I was a child, I loved going to museums. I was one of those unusual kids who the whole rest of the family was like, is it time to go home yet? And I would say, I haven't seen everything yet. So I loved museums my whole life. And much later on, when I decided on a career, at first I thought I wanted to be a graphic designer. Mm. And so as part of taking art courses, I also took art history. And when I took my first art history course, which actually was in high school, that really piqued my interest. Mm-hmm. And I also volunteered at the Cincinnati Art Museum my senior year in high school. And that really cemented for me that I wanted to work in a museum.
Ah, you got a taste for it. What about you, Andy?
Well, I have to give my parents a lot of credit. As a young boy, my dad, who was a biochemist at the time, had a postdoc position in Amsterdam. And so I got to live in Amsterdam for 2 years, between the ages of 6 and 8. And one summer, we toured all the chateaux in the north of France. And another summer, we toured all the cathedrals in the north of France. Mm. So I really sort of had this formative experience with these medieval stones. And I just think it was really sort of, you know, became a part of me at that time, and sort of the medieval era, the late medieval era, and sort of that kind of material culture has always stuck with me. So I've felt from a very early age that I wanted to be a curator and work with objects.
Oh, how interesting. So how does one segue from art history major to becoming a curator? Do you want to start, Andy, with how your adventure began?
Yeah, well, for me, I was, as an undergraduate, I didn't major in art history. I did a medieval studies degree, and then I decided to specialize. I decided that art was the most important part of what I was interested in, and I came to graduate school here at Cornell in the fall of 1990. And just as I was completing my coursework, my advisor let me know that there was an internship available at the Johnson Museum, and would I be interested? And absolutely, I was interested. And so that was a really great experience. So for me, it began with an internship. And I've mm-hmm. been a longtime museum goer, of course, and very interested in museums. But that was my first taste of the inner workings of a museum and what a career as a curator would be like.
Fascinating. What about you, Ellen? How did you go from art history to curator?
Well, because I knew I wanted to work in a museum eventually, I deliberately chose an art history program that was at a university that had an art museum so that I would have a chance to, you know, possibly work in the museum as an intern. So I studied at the University of Kansas, which is well known for its Asian art history, and I worked in the Spencer Museum of Art while I was there. And then after I finished my master's degree, I was a little bit tired of school, and so I decided to take a little break before doing a PhD. So I went back home to Cincinnati, and I was working for my father in his business in order to, you know, save some money to continue my graduate studies. And I also went back to the Cincinnati Art Museum, and I volunteered to work there. And because I now had my master's degree in Chinese art, the curator of Asian art said, sure, I'd love to have you work with me. So I started working in the department, and I was only a volunteer for about 2 months. And they hired me on a one-year appointment to help with an exhibition that they were bringing in.
So that's how you got interested in Asian art.
So that's how I got into, that was my first museum job. And then I thought, well, at the end of that year, I'll just, you know, go to graduate school and continue on with my studies. And toward the end of the year, the museum decided it was going to hire assistant curators in all the departments. And so I was hired as the assistant curator.
Oh, interesting. So
I never did go back and do my PhD. I did a lot of my training on the job.
That's great. That's the best way to do it, I think.
It was great training, yeah.
And so Andy, you're interested in and have expertise in Renaissance and Baroque works on paper. How did you narrow it down to that subject?
Well, I've always been interested in early modern Europe, as I was explaining, with my interest in medieval culture. And I started in my graduate work, I started to work on 16th century France and Italy, and specifically the artists who were the first to make the jump from Italy to work at the court in France. And my working on this project for my thesis coincided directly with beginning to work at the Johnson Museum, specifically with their collection of works on paper. And that introduced me to a really wonderful hands-on experience with prints, etchings, engravings, woodcuts that were made in the 16th and 17th centuries. And I had a really great mentor in Nancy Green, who is still our senior curator, and Todd Wyman, who at that time was working in the department. He's now on staff at a major auction house in New York. Mm. And you see him all the time on Antiques Roadshow appraising works on paper. I learned so much from them and became passionately interested in the nuances of looking at prints and the connoisseurship of works on paper.
Wow.
So those two interests sort of melded together, and that's still where I'm at. My greatest area of interest is between about 1490 and about 1700.
That's a long time ago. Now, one thing that I really want to talk about with you guys, I want you to take us through the first steps in the creation of an exhibit. Now, how does that happen? Do curators get involved? Is there a board who decides what an exhibit's going to look like, what it's going to be, how it's going to be titled? Who wants to start with this discussion?
Every exhibition is different.
Mm.
Sometimes exhibitions come out of ideas that we have for, you know, doing something from the permanent collection, for example. You know, maybe a theme, you know, we'd like to explore, or a particular artist or whatever. So those are kind of self-generated ideas, in-house exhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our exhibitions, we take rental shows. So exhibitions that are offered by another museum or an exhibition service that is circulating an exhibition, and we'll join the tour and pay a rental fee and bring in the show. And then our curator's role is really to plan our installation of it, and is not so much developing the content of the exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there are some exhibitions where, you know, we hear about a private collection. And this happens a lot in our museum because Cornell alumni, many of them are art collectors. And so we hear about collections belonging to alumni, and we've done exhibitions of those. And oftentimes the collector has a particular focus. So it allows us to explore a particular subject, but it all comes from one collection.
Well, what about you, Andy? What's your experience been? Is it different?
To some degree, it's quite similar in terms of you, as a curator, you respond to, especially a curator at a university museum where you have all sorts of different constituents with whom you work all over campus. You respond to the needs of the university and the curriculum, and so you plan exhibitions that are themed to or at least complement certain professors' course offerings and things like that. Those are usually smaller permanent collection exhibitions, but my experience in my sort of broader position beyond works on paper, I have, as you probably noticed, a sort of custodianship over a lot of different aspects mm-hmm. of the collection. That's been really wonderful, being approached by collectors of a lot of different types of material and sort of learning on the job as a new collector who owns something perhaps that is very divergent from my area of knowledge. It's one of the great things about my job that I enjoy quite a lot. For example, the exhibition that's up right now of Australian Aboriginal paintings is not something that I've officially been trained in, but it's been a terrific learning experience. A collector who had a significant collection of this material came forward, and it took about 10 years to finally affect the exhibition that is on view right now.
Uh-huh. Do you guys feel like you're learning all the time?
You never stop.
Right?
And that's really, it's hugely satisfying aspect of the job. I think we're all just, you know, intellectually very curious about all, you know, aspects of art and art history. And so, yeah, it's one of the great things is that we're constantly learning. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we want to share that with the public. So it's a lot of fun.
You know what I'm curious about, too? When you are having an exhibit from a borrowed collection, what kind of care do you have to take? Do you get special instructions to make sure things don't get damaged? How do you take care of priceless pieces?
Well, we give the same care to someone else's collection that we do to our own.
And what kind of care is that, though?
And that means, yes, being extremely careful with how it's packed and shipped and handled and installed in the exhibition. Of course, we carry insurance on it and, you know, and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. But, you know, really our primary responsibility is to make sure that no damage happens. And different types of art have different physical needs and vulnerabilities. And so we, you know, we have to bear those in mind when we're borrowing something and presenting it to the public.
Mm-hmm. I would think works on paper, wouldn't your specialty. I remember going to the Rembrandt Museum in Amsterdam.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
they had to have low light.
Exactly.
Is that a concern with some of the stuff that you deal with as well?
Most definitely. In terms of the level of the light to which the works are permitted to be exposed, it's an amount that's measured in foot candles or lumens, and it has to be 10 foot candles, very low light for works on paper, and also very short duration exposure to light of any kind, as opposed to like a paintings exhibition that you go to see is up for several months, you know, the big blockbuster shows. Mm. Works on paper exhibitions generally have to be limited to about 7 or 8 weeks, because with prolonged exposure to light, the fibers in the paper actually will break down. You know, you can only log so many light exposure hours before work on paper is no more.
Yeah, that's a scary thought, that we could lose some of this stuff, you know, based on people not
absolutely.
Knowing how to exhibit it correctly.
Right.
Sure.
Right,
oh, sure. Sure.
And then that must
sure.
be something that you learn.
Right.
Yes.
And
yes.
Hopefully you don't learn on the job.
Well, some of it we do. I mean, some of it we do learn on the job. And professionals in conservation, in art conservation, are, you know, extremely helpful to us as curators. And, you know, I think Andy, you know, would agree that we've both learned a lot from working with art conservators who have the background in science and the physical demands of various types of works of art and how best to care for them. So we work closely with other people who are also particularly experts in that.
Did you actually work with scientists then that have expertise in materials and degradation?
Yes, absolutely. And we learn a lot from that study of art, you know, for how to care for our collections.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guests are Ellen Averill and Andy Weisslogel. They are curators with the Johnson Museum on Cornell University's campus. Now, so many museums are borrowing and, you know, shipping. And how often do things actually get damaged? Do you have any idea?
I don't know that I have a statistic or anything, you know, really concrete.
Had anything arrive damaged?
Sure. Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, sometimes it's because it was inadequately packed or, you know, something happened in the shipment. Damage happens.
That's so sad. I was hoping you were going to say it hardly ever happens in this day.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I mean, it very, very rarely happens, but it's a part of being in a museum, you know, and you just have to be ready to respond to it properly when it happens.
It's the part that would break your heart, too.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about research. I know that research is always being done, especially on permanent collections. How does that take place? Are you pulling things out of, you know, in cobwebbed closets that haven't been looked at and doing more modern research on things? Tell us.
Well, we try not to have cobwebs in our closets. We try to keep the closets very clean.
I don't think we have closets, actually.
Warehouses. I'm not sure where things are stored.
We do have storage areas in the museum. And only about 2% of our collection is on display at any one time. And there are many reasons for that, one of which we've already discussed, which is that, you know, a large part of our collection is works on paper. Mm. So they're very light sensitive, and we can't have them out all the time. And we need to have a large enough collection in reserve so that we're not overexposing any of those precious works of art. Mm-hmm. We also have, you know, many more things that have been given to the museum than we have space to show. But we change our displays, mm-hmm. and we, you know, and we do temporary exhibitions out of the permanent collection. So having those kind of reserve collections are, you know, a rich resource that we draw upon, mm-hmm. And that we do, you know, make use of.
And are you constantly having to do new research on stuff or finding out new
information? Oh, yes. We're always doing research on the collections and finding out new things. And as art historians in the wider world and archaeologists are, you know, studying more and more about these things, you know, that affects the pieces that are in our collection and how much we know about them.
Mm-hmm. You have anything to add about that?
Yeah, I think it's a great sort of cyclical process because as we, you know, as we pursue our sort of twin missions of researching our own permanent collection, then, you know, the logical follow to that is sharing what we've learned. And so, you know, for example, the birth date of a famous artist comes along or something like that, and that provides us with an opportunity to revisit what we might have in the collection by that artist, such as when Rembrandt had his 400th birthday a few years back. That causes us to turn an eye back on what we have by that artist in our collection. We often make new and interesting discoveries, and we're able to share those discoveries with other people. And what's neat about exhibitions that happen sort of on that basis is you often, of course, Rembrandt's 400th birthday, everybody and his brother had an exhibition celebrating that. So it was a great collegial activity. I got to find out from fellow print curators all around the country, you know, what they were doing to celebrate Rembrandt, what they had, and hey, you know, that might come in handy in a future exhibition as a loan or something like that. So it's a constant, and then the next topic comes up. So it's a constant microscope turned back on the collection.
Are there still art mysteries out there that you guys know of? I mean, things in collections that are not really by the artist that for hundreds of years we thought they were. Do you have any information about that? I'm always curious about that.
Well, I think it happens all the time. I don't know if I can think of any real sort of sensational ones right offhand in our own collection, but you know, reattributions of works that were thought to be by a different artist, that goes on all the time. And that goes hand in hand with the research point. You know, if someone is researching a particular artist or a particular type of art, they make a discovery. That discovery sends ripples out across other curatorial departments, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. attributions flip-flop. And sometimes it has to do with the paper that a particular thing is printed on, new discoveries mm-hmm. made about that. Mm-hmm. Stylistic mm-hmm. characteristics, those kinds of things. Yeah, it happens all the time, and sometimes it can affect the monetary value of a piece.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
Some people are often very resistant to the attribution of an artist changing on their piece.
I can imagine that.
Likewise, some discoveries are made in the process of conservation treatment on a work. Mm. For example, we had a Chinese painting which was in a private collection and was given to the museum after we did an exhibition of their collection. And during the process of preparing the exhibition, we had this painting needed to be remounted and conserved. It had some damage and some old damage and that sort of thing. In the process of conservation, it was discovered that by the conservator, when he started to clean the painting, that someone had added all kinds of charcoal drawing on top of the ink painting.
Oh my gosh.
And so he did a little test cleaning area and he called me and he said, you know, someone in the past has messed around with this painting and covered up the original ink and brush strokes. And he said, I did a little test cleaning area and I found that the ink strokes underneath this are much better looking. So I said, well, let's go ahead and, you know, clean it. There's no reason that there should be any charcoal markings on a Chinese ink painting. I mean, that's
indeed.
Clearly was
yeah.
not an artist's original intent. So he cleaned it, and it turned out to be a very different looking landscape painting than what it started out as, and actually a much better painting than any of us had ever thought.
How interesting.
And that was only discovered, you know, in the process of conservation treatment. So sometimes what appears to us on the surface is not the true nature of that work of art.
How fascinating that would be. You guys are both experts, you in Asian art and you in some of these paper arts, Renaissance and so on. Do you think you could tell a fake?
Very definitely. I can tell faked forgeries in works on paper, not with 100% degree of accuracy, but there are a lot of fakes and forgeries out there that are very, very easy to tell.
And are people doing that to try to just fool people or try to make money? What's the point of doing that?
There's a lot of different shades of it. You know, early on, it was copying another artist's work was seen as an homage, and it wasn't necessarily seen as something bad.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, very definitely in the later 19th and 20th century, a lot of works on paper were deliberately forged to fool collectors and that kind of thing. And those, you know, when photographic reproduction became possible, those were definitely for financial gain, and you have to sort of ferret those out.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you can tell a fake? Asian art is such a huge...
Asian art is huge, and with some areas of Asian art, it's particularly tricky, and it's tricky for the experts. So, it's. I don't think anyone can say that they could 100%.
Really?
Be accurate in telling, because sometimes the forging is extremely clever, and there is, you know, there can be forging of ceramics which actually use ground up, you know, old shards of ancient ceramics so that they'll trick the scientific tests for determining when a piece was made. In Chinese painting, it's very, very tricky and has been for centuries. The problem of forgeries and copies has been one that's been with us as long as artists have been making art that is seen to be valuable.
Mm-hmm.
In Chinese painting, for example, it was the tradition to copy the works of old masters as a way of learning, and that you were expected to master the old styles in your ink painting before you were really allowed the freedom to try to work off into your own direction and express yourself personally. Famous Chinese artists in the past couldn't meet all the demands for their work, and so they had ghost painters who would paint paintings that they would sign. So when things get very complicated like that, it's very hard to tell, you know, even if something is of the period, is it really by the artist? Or is it by one of their ghost painters? Or is it by someone outside their workshop who was, you know, trying to make a copy?
It seems to me I remember controversies like that around Andy Warhol and Jackson Pollock. You know, they'd have people, assistants helping them, and sometimes the works were actually not even done by them. Yeah.
Especially in those cases, of artists whose style was deliberately to conceal the specific mark of the artist's hand, like Warhol or somebody like that, you know, whose works were deliberately sort of machine-like.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Now, let's talk about teaching. You both teach. Tell us in what aspects you teach. Are you teaching art appreciation? Are you teaching how to be a curator? Tell us. Andy, you want to begin?
My position is about 50% devoted to teaching, and the majority of what I do, although I do teach courses from time to time, the majority of what I do is meet with Cornell faculty and other instructors to bring an art-related, a collection-related visit to their curriculum.
Mm.
And this happens for me in the regular semester. This happens to me twice or three times a week, usually different professors coming in. So sometimes it's specifically art related. I have a group of fine arts students coming in who are just learning how to make lithographs, and so I show them lithographs, and that's a great thing when that happens. But also, it doesn't necessarily have to be specifically art related. So sometimes I'll have an American history class come in, and we look at American depictions of the landscape, when we talk about manifest destiny, and we talk about, you know, how material culture can link in directly with what they're studying in a historical or even a literary sense and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tremendously diverse and rewarding array of different interactions with different professors. And sometimes it's not always necessarily the humanities. Sometimes it's, for example, we had an entomology class come in and we looked at images of insects from our collection. Mm. And the things you learn from that type of interaction, because those people are minded in they're looking in a totally different way. You know, they can identify species and things like that, and they can tell you things about the works of art that you never dreamed of.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a terrific learning experience, too.
Well, what about you, Ellen, in regard to teaching?
Along with the other curators and professional staff of the museum, we teach a course each year called The Museum and the Object, which is taught through the Art History Department at Cornell. And each one of us teaches one session of the course on our own areas of responsibility in the museum. And the purpose of the course is to expose the students to the issues involved in being a curator, in working with physical objects, and that sort of thing. And the students have as their project, in addition to doing a more traditional kind of research paper, they have to choose a work of art in the museum's collection and pretend like we don't own the object yet. And the student has to propose the object to the museum staff as if we were the board of trustees and make the argument of why we should purchase that piece. And they have to research the price and, all kinds of aspects of the piece that they wouldn't normally think about in a traditional art history class.
Oh, that sounds interesting. We only have a couple minutes left. Tell us about some of the exhibits that are currently at the museum and how long they'll be there.
Yeah, the one I alluded to briefly earlier is called Icons of the Desert, early Aboriginal Paintings from Papunya, and it's a fantastic collection of works that represent a pivotal moment in Australian history when Aboriginal people first transferred their millennia-old sacred designs to a Western permanent art surface.
Mm.
So it represents a tremendous and interesting meeting of cultures. And that's going to be, it's up right now, it's going to be up until April 5th, and we have a fantastic week of events planned. We're starting on Tuesday, the 10th of February. We're going to have three Aboriginal painters making a groundwork in the gallery with sand and plant fibers. And that's open to the public, followed by a number of events that you can track on the museum's website, including an opening, a symposium, and various lectures and that kind of thing.
Great. What about you, Ellen? You have anything coming up?
I don't have a temporary exhibition up in this round, but the museum also has an exhibition called Picturing Eden, which is that's a traveling exhibition that has photographs that show artists various ideas about the environment, some are utopian, some are very ominous kind of images dealing with environmental issues and so on.
That's interesting. And is there a contact email or a contact website that you can give people?
Just go to www.museum.cornell.edu, and it'll all be spelled out for you.
Great. Well, Ellen Averill and Andy Weisslogel, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you
for having us.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.